Stories from General Conference. Fatherhood is the topic of this series of stories from General Conference. The word fatherhood can invoke many meanings. One such meaning pertains to our relationship to our Heavenly Father as His sons and daughters. Another meaning of the word applies to earthly roles as fathers and their relationship to their children here in mortality. In the April 1999 General Conference, Elder Jeffrey R. Holland described the importance of the role of earthly fathers.
As a father, I wonder if I and all other fathers could do more to build a sweeter, stronger relationship with our sons and daughters here on earth. Dads, is it too bold to hope that our children might have some small portion of the feeling for us that the divine son felt for his father? Might we earn more of that love by trying to be more of what God was to his child? In any case, we do know that a young person's developing concept of God centers on characteristics observed in that child's earthly parents. For that reason and many others, I suppose no book I have read in recent months has alarmed me more than a work entitled Fatherless America. In this study, the author speaks of fatherlessness as the most harmful demographic trend of this generation, the leading cause of damage to children. It is, he is convinced, the engine driving our most urgent social problems, from poverty to crime to adolescent pregnancy to child abuse to domestic violence. Among the principal social issues of our time is the flight of fathers from their children's lives. Of even greater concern than the physical absenteeism of some fathers is the spiritually or emotionally absent father. These are fatherly sins of omission that are probably more destructive than sins of commission. Why are we not surprised that when 2,000 children of all ages and backgrounds were asked what they appreciated most about their fathers, they answered universally, "He spends time with me." A young Laurel I met on a conference assignment not long ago wrote to me after our visit and said, "I wish my dad knew how much I need him spiritually and emotionally. I crave any kind comment, any warm personal gesture. I don't think he knows how much it would mean to me to have him take an active interest in what is going on in my life, to offer to give me a blessing, or just spend time together. I know he worries that he won't do the right thing or won't say the words well, but just to have him try would mean more than he could ever know. I don't want to sound ungrateful," she says, "because I know he loves me. He sent me a note once and signed it, Love, Dad." I treasure that note. I hold it among my dearest possessions.
Fatherhood can be sprinkled with experiences that help us develop patience, self-control, and forgiveness. These are virtues that most of us need more work on. Often, these experiences are not always so funny when they happen, but later are laughed about as they are retold. Such an experience was told by Elder Robert C. Oakes in the October 2006 General Conference.
Recently, I attended the funeral of a lifelong friend. His son told a beautiful story of parental patience. When his son was in his youth, his dad owned a motorcycle dealership. And one day they received a shipment of shiny new motorcycles, and they lined them all up in the store. The boy did what every boy would like to do, and he climbed up on the closest one. He even started it up. Then, when he figured he had pushed his luck far enough, he jumped off. To his dismay, his dismount knocked the first bike down. Then, like a string of dominoes, they all went down, one after another. His dad heard the commotion, looked out from behind the partition where he was working, and slowly smiling, he said, "Well, son, we better fix one up and sell it so that we can pay for the rest of them." I think my friend's response personifies parental patience.
Fathers and their children should work to develop sacred bonds of trust and love between them. In the priesthood session of the April 2001 General Conference, President James E. Faust gave two examples.
When Elder LeGrand Richards left to attend college, his father, George F. Richards, said to him and his brother, George F. Jr., "I would trust you two to go anywhere I would go myself." Their hearts swelled with love and pride in his words. LeGrand later said, "They put rods of steel in our spine, and we couldn't do anything that would disappoint them." A father should never consciously disappoint his wife or children. In 1989, there was a terrible earthquake in Armenia that killed over 300,000 people in 4 minutes. A distraught father went into a frantic search for his son. He reached his son's school only to find that it had been reduced to a pile of rubble. But he was driven by his promise to his son, "No matter what, I will always be there for you." He visualized the corner where his son's classroom would be, rushed there, and started to dig through the debris, brick by brick. Others came on the scene, the fire chief, then the police, warning him of fires and explosions and urging him to leave the search to emergency crews. But he tenaciously carried on digging. Night came and went, and then in the 38th hour of digging, he thought he heard his son's voice. "Armand," he called out, and he heard, "Dad, it's me, Dad. I told the other kids not to worry. I told him that if you were alive, you'd save me. And when you'd saved me, they'd be saved. There are 14 of us left out of the 33. When the building collapsed, it made a wedge like a triangle, and it saved us." "Come on out, boy." "No, Dad. Let the other kids out first, because I know you'll get me no matter what. I know you'll be there for me."
Lessons on fatherhood are sometimes learned as they are passed from one generation to the next. Frequently, these lessons are amusing as we look back on them. In the priesthood session of the October 2002 General Conference, President Thomas S. Monson related two stories, one about his father and the other about himself as a father.
"I recall how much, as a youngster, I liked dogs. One day I took my wagon and placed a wooden orange crate in it and went looking for dogs. At that time, dogs were everywhere to be found. At school, walking along the sidewalks, or exploring vacant lots, of which there were many. As I would find a dog and capture it, I placed it in the crate, took it home, locked it in the coal shed, turned the latch on the door. That day, I think I brought home 6 dogs of varying sizes and made them my prisoners after this fashion. I had no idea what I'd do with all those dogs, so I didn't reveal any of this deed to anyone. Dad came home from work, and as was his custom, took the coal bucket and went to the coal shed to fill it. Can you imagine his shock and utter consternation as he opened the door and immediately faced 6 dogs, all attempting to escape at once? Some of them were big dogs. As I recall, Dad flushed a little bit, and then he calmed down and quietly told me, "Tommy, coal sheds are for coal. Other people's dogs rightfully belong to them." By observing him, I learned a lesson in patience and calmness. It's a good thing I did, For a similar event occurred in my life with our youngest son, Clark. Clark has always liked animals, birds, reptiles, anything that is alive. Sometimes that resulted in a little chaos in our home. One day in his boyhood, he came home from Provo Canyon with a water snake, which he named Herman. Right off the bat, Herman got lost. Sister Monson found him in the silverware drawer. I shan't illustrate other places she found Herman. Water snakes have a way of being where you least expect them. Well, Clark moved Herman to the bathtub, put a plug in the drain, put a little water in, washcloth at the end, and had a sign taped to the back of the tub, which read, "Don't use this tub. It belongs to Herman." So we had to use the other bathroom while Herman occupied that sequestered place. But then one day, to our amazement, Herman disappeared. His name should have been Houdini. He was gone. So the next day, Sister Monson cleaned up the tub, prepared it for normal use. Several days went by. One evening, I decided it was time to take a leisurely bath. So I filled the tub with a lot of warm water, and then I peacefully lay down in the tub for a few moments of relaxation. I was lying there just pondering when the soapy water reached the level of the overflow drain and began to flow through it. Can you imagine my surprise with my eyes focused on that drain? Herman came swimming out right for my face. I yelled out to my wife, "Frances, here comes Herman." Well, Herman was captured again, put in a foolproof box, and we made a little excursion to Vivian Park and Provo Canyon, and there released Herman into the beautiful waters of the South Fork Creek. Herman was never again to be seen by us.
In the priesthood session of the October 2001 General Conference, President James E. Faust shared a story told by Elder Henry B. Eyring about his father. It was an example of commitment and an experience he never forgot.
A story shared by our beloved associate, Elder Henry B. Eyring, illustrates this principle of commitment still further. This story is about his father, the great scientist Henry Eyring, who served on the Bonneville Stake High Council. He was responsible for the welfare farm, which included a field of onions that needed to be weeded. At that time, he was nearly 80 and suffering from painful bone cancer. He assigned himself to do weeding, even though the pain was so great that he pulled himself along on his stomach with his elbows. The pain was too great for him to kneel, yet he smiled, laughed, and talked happily with the others who were there that day weeding that field of onions. I now quote what Elder Eyring said of this incident. "After all the work was finished and the onions were all weeded, someone said to him, 'Henry, good heavens, you didn't pull those weeds, did you? Those weeds were sprayed 2 days ago, and they were going to die anyway.' Dad just roared. He thought that was the funniest thing. He said it was a great joke on himself. He had worked through the day on the wrong weeds. They had been sprayed and would have died anyway. I asked him, 'Dad, how could you make a joke out of that?' He said something to me that I will never forget. He said, 'Hal, I wasn't there for the weeds.'"
Pride and stubbornness can result in strained or isolated relationships between a father and his children. We must guard against this and do all we can to avoid it. In the priesthood session of the October 2003 General Conference, President Thomas S. Monson told the story of how a strained relationship between a father and a son was repaired and tragedy narrowly averted.
There are those families comprised of mothers and fathers, sons and daughters, who have, through thoughtless comment, isolated themselves from one another. An account of how such a tragedy was narrowly averted occurred many years ago in the life of a young man who, for purposes of privacy, I shall call Jack. Throughout Jack's life, he and his father had many serious arguments. One day when he was 17, they had a particularly violent one. Jack said to his father, "This is the straw that breaks the camel's back. I'm leaving home, and I shall never return." So saying, he went to the house and packed his bag. His mother begged him to stay. He was too angry to listen. He left her crying at the doorway. Leaving the yard, he was about to pass through the gate when he heard his father call to him, "Jack, I know that a large share of the blame for your leaving rests with me. For this, I'm truly sorry. I want you to know that if you should ever wish to return home, you'll always be welcome. And I'll try to be a better father to you. I want you to know that I'll always love you." Jack said nothing. He went to the bus station and bought a ticket to a distant point. As he sat on the bus, watching the miles go by, he commenced to think about the words of his father. He began to realize how much love it had required for him to do what he had done. Dad had apologized. He had invited him back and left the words ringing in the summer air, "I love you." It was then that Jack realized that the next move was up to him. He knew the only way he could ever find peace with himself was to demonstrate to his father the same kind of maturity, goodness, and love that Dad had shown toward him. Jack got off the bus. He bought a return ticket and went back. He arrived shortly after midnight, entered the house, turned on the light. There in the rocking chair sat his father, his head in his hands. As he looked up and saw Jack, he arose from the chair and they rushed into each other's arms. Jack often said, "Those last years that I was home were among the happiest of my life." We could say that here was a boy who overnight became a man. Here was a father who, suppressing passion and bridling pride, rescued his son before he became one of that vast lost battalion resulting from fractured families and shattered homes. Love was the binding band, the healing balm. Love, so often felt, so seldom expressed.
Time spent with your family and healthy interaction with each member always pays great dividends in developing strong and everlasting bonds. In the April 2004 General Conference, Elder W. Douglas Shumway gave two such examples, one about a blind hurdler, the other a personal experience from his own life.
The family is central to the Creator's plan for the eternal destiny of His children. Therefore, parents and children must work together in unity to fortify family relationships, cultivating them day in and day out. I have a brother who was associated with large university. He told of a student athlete who was an outstanding hurdler. The young man was blind. Rex asked him, "Don't you ever fall?" "I have to be exact," the athlete responded. "I measure each time before I jump. One time I didn't, and I nearly killed myself." The young man then spoke of the countless hours his father had devoted over the years teaching, helping, and showing him how to hurdle until he became one of the best. How could this young man fail with a team like that, a father and a son? Young men and women, you can be a great influence for good in your homes as you help to achieve worthy family objectives. I shall never forget the family home evening years ago, in which the name of each member of our family was placed in a hat. The name you picked from the hat would be your secret friend for the week. You can imagine the love that filled my heart when I came home that Tuesday after work to sweep out the garage as I had earlier promised and found it cleanly swept. There was a note attached to the garage door which read, "Hope you had a good day, your secret friend." And on Friday night, as I turned down my bed, I uncovered an Almond Joy, my favorite candy bar, wrapped carefully in scotch tape and plain white paper with a note, "Dad, I love you a lot. Thanks, your secret friend." Then to top it off, after returning home from a late meeting Sunday evening, I found the dining room table beautifully set, and written on the napkin by my place were the words, "Super Dad," in big bold letters and in parentheses, "Your secret friend." Hold your family home evenings, for this is where the gospel is taught, a testimony gained, and the family fortified.
The love that can develop between a father and child is nearly indescribable. The plan of our Heavenly Father intends it to be that way. Time taken to nurture that relationship is always well spent. In the October 2002 General Conference, Elder F. Melvin Hammond related this poignant experience with his small son.
Many years ago, I took our only son on his first camping fishing trip. He was just a boy. The canyon was steep and the descent was difficult, but the fishing was good. Every time I hooked a fish, I would give the pole to the eager boy, and with shouts of joy, he would reel in a beautiful trout. In the shadows and coolness of the late afternoon, we began our climb back up to the rim high above us. He scrambled rapidly up the mountain ahead of me with a challenging, "Come on, Dad, I'll bet I can beat you to the top." The challenge was heard, but wisely ignored. His small frame seemed literally to fly over, under, and around every obstacle. And when every step that I took seemed ridiculously like my last, he had reached the top and stood cheering me on. After supper, we knelt in prayer. His small voice rose sweetly heavenward in benediction to our day. Then we climbed into our large double sleeping bag, and after a bit of pushing and pulling, I felt his little body snuggle and settle tightly against mine for warmth and security against the night. As I looked at my son beside me, suddenly I felt a surge of love pass through my body with such force that it pushed tears to my eyes. And at that precise moment, he put his little arms around me and said, "Dad?" "Yes, son." "Are you awake?" "Yes, my son, I am awake. Dad, I love you a million trillion times." And immediately he was asleep. But I was awake far into the night, expressing my great thanks for such wonderful blessings clothed with a little boy's body. Now my son is a man with a son of his own. Once in a while, the three of us go fishing. I look at my little red-headed grandson beside his father, and I see in my mind's eye the image of that wonderful moment long ago. The question so innocently asked, "Dad, are you awake?" still rings in my heart. To every father, I pose the same penetrating question. "Dad, are you awake? Do your sons ever wonder if you're asleep when it comes to the things that are most important to them?"
This has been Stories from General Conference. The topic was fatherhood. Thank you for listening to The Mormon Channel.